Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me here. This is actually a new project that my student Anthony Palotran has worked, and he's continued to doing his master's thesis on this. And everything started, of course, with I, an applied mathematician, trying to make sense of what clinicians, mainly neurosurgeons, need when they look at tumors. And the more important part is, can you find a non-invasive way to distinct between a benign and a malignant tumor? And this actually started this particular work. And of course, because I'm part of Center for Neuroengineering, this is actually focusing on how to distinct low-grade, which are non-invasive gliomas, from the high-grade gliomas, which are actually the most aggressive ones. And so mainly what I'm going to talk about is, first I'm going to introduce very quickly the magnetic resonance elastography, which was... I still have problems with this, but anyway, which was actually proposed about 15 years ago by the research at Bayer Clinic. Can I try the other way? My ears are not designed to do it the British way.
I think Lady Gaga used it.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. Okay. About 15 years ago, the guys at Mayo Clinic decided to actually try to invest the stiffness of the tissue using the imaging procedures that are used usually in clinical studies. And they came up with evaluating the stiffness of a tissue using the magnetic resonance. You can use ultrasound, you can use anything else. And really, this is actually a very interesting picture of an experiment they run there. This is a classic MRI image of a prostate tissue that has cancer in it. Any single radiologist looking at this image is going to give you different results because they are trained visually. So their assessment is actually based on their experience. Okay. Now, this is what the pathologist is going to say. He's going to say, hello, you have a big tumor lying in here. Okay. The elastography, if you actually look at really how stiff the tissue is going to actually show you that you have stiffer regions here. So really, if you can, if this would be a much better and more objective way to assess where the tumor is, and non-invasively, that's the most important part. Now, so I'm going to focus in particular of how to use this magnetic elastography on the brain. And now, of course, the problem still stays. Okay, we have this process of finding stiffer regions in a tissue. However, how can we distinct between different tumors, right? How I can say that this is a low-grade or this is a high-grade glioma, for example? And it is here where this very new process called image mass spectroscopy can actually come to hand. It's a paper in 2007 by a group that actually showed how you can actually distinct between the two of them using this process. Okay, so here actually this is a sample of a breast tissue, and the boundaries are actually delimitating different parts of different regions of different proteins inside the tissue. And finally, this is the last piece that we just started to work on doing the growth model. Mainly, the most important part is bringing the mechanics inside all of those diffusion reaction equations that are out in the literature, because mechanics is determined by the biochemical reactions happening, and vice versa. Any biochemical reaction is going to affect the mechanics. That being said, let's have a look and see what MRE is all about. So the idea is, of course, something that you all pretty much know, and probably the easiest thing is to think about tumors. If you actually have a tumor, usually the classical method is, especially for the breast testing, is you palpate and you feel that something is actually hard inside, right? And that's the first signal that something is funny going on inside the inside the breast, right? So it's starting on this particular clinical or physical observation that tumors tend to be harder than the soft tissue. They said, how can we use this information inside the imaging process? So this is the thing that we are trying to find material parameters of biological materials in vivo and map them in anatomical meaningful images that are of use to clinicians. And this is what's called an elastogram. And of course, applications. In clinical diagnostic procedures, that's the most powerful one, and this was actually the beginning of all this story. So elastography was fancy called palpation by imaging. Can be used in trauma and surgical simulations, and this is also very important, especially for the brain. You can't perform experiments to study trauma. You actually have to simulate those. And then, of course, in design of prosthetic and prosthetic and protective devices, as you know, Penn State has this huge NFL football thing, and they claim that there is no damage to the brain and they can play forever. That's not true. So we are trying to argue that really lots of bumps into your head are going to actually cause damage on the long run. The image modalities are, of course, ultrasound, MRI, optics, and depending on which image modality you use, they are receiving different names. The parameters you can image, whatever you think is useful, strain, stress, mechanical stress, not the biochemical type of stress that was mentioned earlier, so this is mechanical stress, velocity, amplitude, phase, whatever is making sense to the particular problem you are looking at. And now, what type of excitations, mechanical excitations we can envision? The tissue can be compressed, okay, so that's the static elastography. We can use a time harmonic excitation made on the boundary that is going to create a time harmonic wave in the tissue, and that's the dynamic elastography. We can use a time dependent pulse on the boundary that is going to create a propagating wave in the tissue, and this is a transient elastography, which actually turns out to be very useful if you want to simulate brain trauma, right? It's just going to be a very strong pulse and then you see what's happening. And another one is the remote elastography when you use acoustic radiation forces focused at a chosen location. Now, I'm following the procedure that the guys at Mayo Clinic developed, and they mainly use dynamic MR elastography. So what we are doing, we have the MR scanner, and you start to record images while a vibrating plate is actually placed on the skin and provides mechanic shear waves into the tissue. As you probably realize, we can have two types of waves propagating, longitudinal and shear. Longitudinal waves turns out that propagate very fast, so you can actually forget about them and focus on the shear. If we actually manage to put in tune the MR scanner with the mechanical vibrations, then the waves appear like are frozen, and we can actually measure the wavelength. And a particular type of encoding, which is the phase contrast MRI, is going to be is based on the change in the phase shifts of the flowing photons in the regions of interest to create an image, right? This is a classical way of generating an MR image. Now, in the linear regime, it turns out that the phase difference field is directly proportional to the displacement field. So now I can relate this to directly to a mechanical model. And of course, once the displacement field is known, we're going to need certain constitutive assumptions about the tissue in order to find the material parameters. This is an inverse problem, and that's all I need to say about it, because as you all know, inverse problems are the toughest ones in math to deal with. Now, what the guys at Mayo did, so this is the schematic, okay, so these are the usual MR gradients that they apply, and this is the synchronous mechanical device they use. You can use two actuators. One is here, this is actually very uncomfortable. What this was doing was actually bumping up and down at 100 hertz in the back of the head. The engineer, now engineers usually do experiments on the SAS. The guy who did the experiment 5 minutes later left and disappeared for a week because he had headaches from it. So they have to be very careful about these devices. The other one that is more safe is this actuator in the mouth, which actually shakes back and forth. And that turns out to be a little bit safer. However, there is a group at University of Manchester which last year managed to show that, hey, we can actually use the natural pulsations of the brain to do this. And that's much better because really, what's happening here, we are actually sending mechanical waves from outside the body. The brain is the most famous heterogeneous material that you can have. So it's not clear cut that whatever they do here is going to actually not alter somehow the way the brain is going to respond to it, to the force. So probably using the natural pulsations of the brain is a better way of proceeding. So these are the two experiments they provided. So now let's go to the mechanical model. So the continuity assumptions that are used so far is, and that are totally far away from what the really brain is. Anyway, it's local homogeneous, isotropic, almost incompressible linear viscoelastic biological tissue. So this is the mechanical stress, this is the displacement, and this is really the way it looks like. So lambda and mu now become are the classical lambda coefficients that now are functions of time. And now, of course, the Navier equation for displacement in the frequency domain is going to look pretty much the same as the Navier equations for the in the elastic case. And now, looking at biological tissues, what was observed is that lambda is actually it's of order of 10 to the power 9 pascals, and is not changing with pathology. So really, if you can eliminate lambda, you are fine with it. M, on the other hand, varies strongly with tissue pathology. So as I said, shear waves are probably the most important, contain the most important information for pathological reasons. Now, biological tissues are almost incompressible, so really, Navier equations can be reduced just to this very apparently simple equation, which Oliphant inverted algebraically. This is the dirtiest way to invert an equation, and it's not, of course, as you probably feel, the correct way of doing things. Why? Because of all these second-order derivatives that are going to blow up with any single noise signal or any measurement errors that you have. So as I said before, some regularization techniques will be required in order to make this more robust. However, if we introduce the shear wave speed in this way, this is the way an elastogram looks like. So really, this is just an MRI, a classic MRI, on which we overimposed the values of this shear wave. Okay? So what we actually notice is that the white matter value, so white matter is somewhere here, is an average of 14 kilopascal, while the gray matter value, the gray matter is around here, is about 5.3 kilopascal. Whatever you see white is CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, and it's white because shear waves are not going to propagate through the fluid. Okay? So this is what they managed to obtain, and everybody was very happy. Again, these are values that are average over the entire brain. That's not right. The brain is structured very differently depending on the function that is provided. Whoever have ever seen those neurons, the way they actually connected the microstructure, it is very different. So although so take this as a grain of salt, okay? It's something is good, but nevertheless, lots of work still has to be done to find the correct parameters. Now, as I mentioned before, last year at the ISMRI meeting, this group from Manchester managed to actually use the natural pulsations of the brain to find the stiffness parameters of the brain. So that's actually going in the right direction, because really that's what you want. You want the things to be measured in vivo. However, the interesting part is that no elastograms of brain tumors have been reported yet. And that's actually correct in the sense that, as I said, especially for a patient with a glioma, you don't want to put this patient under a mechanical force, regardless how big or small that frequency is. You do not know what kind of damage you can actually cause. But with this work that Zhao has done with the natural pulsations, there is hope that we can actually proceed that way. Right, so that's the good part. So no elastograms means that not so far, but there are good chances to get them. Now, what is the problem now? All the microscopic models of classical continuum mechanics used in the elastography cannot differentiate between low and high grade gliomas or any benign and malignant tumors. We need information from microstructure and biochemical processes of the healthy and diseased brain in order to proceed further. Okay? So it is here where we said, okay, this is where we are. Can we find a threshold? Can we say, this is how much how stiff the low grade glioma is, and look how the high grade glioma is. If we can find a threshold, then the clinician can say, oh, if it's above 20 kilopascal, then it's high glioma. If it's below, then you are still kind of safe. Kind of safe because, as you probably know, sometimes low glioma can turn into high glioma. So it's not easy. So in this moment, we decided to look at image mass spectroscopy. I will make a short notice here. There is a process called magnetic resonance spectroscopy, okay, where they actually use the magnetic resonance scanner to do spectroscopy as well. It is a profiling process, and I'm not very happy with that one. I need the distribution of the density on an image. So although it is possible to do that with the magnetic resonance, I prefer this new technique. Okay, so there are two models of data acquisition, the classic profiling one and this new imaging one. So the profiling is really the classical spectroscopy process. We compare protein patterns from a discrete number, a maximum of 20 spots of areas across a given tissue section. The way it goes is you apply a matrix as discrete doplets or spots to the regions of interest, and the sample is placed into the mass spectroscopy source. This is a number about 200 to 500 nanoliter droplets of matrix are deposited using this an automatic pipette. And a laser beam irradiates then each sample spot, and ion signals from a consecutive shot are averaged across the droplet surface, generating the mass spectrum. So that's the classic, if you want, this is the classic time-to-flight spectrometer, the way it actually works. The image mass spectroscopy displays a detailed molecular image of an entire tissue section. So this is why it becomes of interest to us. The matrix is homogeneously deposited across the section. Thousands of spots can define the array with each spot associated with a full mass spectrum. A control software then is used to set a data acquisition grid that defines the Cartesian pattern across the sample surface. And then the mass spectrum data is acquired using this green pattern. And again, the laser has to be used again to activate the ionization. The intensity for each mass signal at every acquisition coordinate is integrated and the 2D ion density map is reconstructed. And therefore, from a single acquisition, several hundred images, each at a specific molecular weight, can be reconstructed. So this was what Charlesworth was using. So this is the classic profile. This is where the slice is located. The mass spectra is acquired here. The protein profiles usually look like this, while the protein image is in this place. You can have a seat there, please. Okay, so this is what Chorak published in 2005. So if you actually look, this is the low-grade, and this is the high-grade gliomas. What's happening here is the stars indicate the points where the two type of tumors are very different. So that's actually the interesting part, and this is, of course, mass-to-charge ratio, which is seen to correspond to the time of flight, right? Of the ions. So we said, okay, that's fine, and it's kind of useless for the elastography part because I can't convert this information in any way. However, these are the image mass spectrums. So this is the high grade and this is the low grade that they use, so small tissues, and here we have the ion density maps, the images. The white regions, of course, are going to correspond to the high protein concentrations. So now the question will come, okay, can we use this information for the elastography purpose? And the answer is yes. And this is the assumptions we had to go through in order, because no experiments have been done yet, right? So when the next step is going to be, we actually show this project to Dr. Lanagan, who is the director of the Material Research Institute at Penn State. And we got him excited so much that this term, when he's actually doing his sabbatical, he decided to learn himself about imaging processes. To actually help us in doing the experiments. Okay, so what we assumed. Hilbrashi showed that the relative intensities of proteins that are given by the mass spectra are proportional to the corresponding concentration. Now, if I have the corresponding concentrations, then I can define an apparent Young modulus. I'm not going to dare to say that it's the Young modulus. I'm going to call it apparent or relative, okay? So I'm allowing myself an uncertainty here. Is proportional to the concentrations of protein present in the tissue. So we propose this expression for the Young modulus to be the sum of powers of concentrations of the proteins at a certain alpha n, which should, of course, depend on the mass-to-charge ratio somehow. And of course, we started with the two simplest possible cases, take alpha and constant, or define a certain relationship between alpha n and the mass to charge ratio. And the way we picked up the constants was mainly saying, oh, these are gliomas. Therefore, in the regions where the normal tissue is present, I should expect a 14 kilopascal value, right? Which was the value that the MR elastography was giving us. So it was really a trial and error to figure out these values. And look what happened. This is the high glioma values, and this is actually the elastograms. These are the elastograms using the Young modulus we proposed. And it turns out that for a constant alpha, the high glioma was approximately 60 kilopascal, while the low glioma was about 45. Now, constant alpha doesn't make too much sense to us, so we said, okay, what if it's varying with the mass-to-charge ratio? And this is what we obtained. The high glioma is actually 40, and probably the low glioma is 25. The bottom line here is that high glioma does actually turns out to be at least 10 kilopascal stiffer than the low glioma. And that's where we're after, to see where each one of them lies. So this looks very promising. The idea would be now to see the experiments and figure out, okay, is this actually real, or we are just playing games here. And now the last part that I'm going to talk is about the drought model. There is a little bit of a strange thing in the literature. We have the drought models from the mathematical biology, which deals mainly with diffusion equations. And then we have the mechanics here, which deals with mechanics. And really, the two of them, they should be connected somehow. And it is here where we're trying to see how to actually properly connect the two problems. We started, of course, making the assumptions that Hogger does in the modeling mechanically the tumor growth. Okay, so their models are purely mechanics. Volumetric growth, what does that mean? It describes only geometric changes, okay? Material points are dense during growth. In other words, no new material points are showing up during the growth. The intrinsic mechanical properties of the material do not change during growth. Aha, that's not probably the case. And we also assume isotropic growth. But anyway, we have to start somewhere. And we also assume that, of course, the easiest way out is isotropic homogeneous linear elastic solid material for this time. And what we're actually designing is the following experiment. We say we have an undeformed state, this is our tumor. We have a drought state, and we assume the drought to be given by this tensor. And we assume that on the top of this, we have a uniaxial stretch, okay? Which, and this is the deformation gradient here, okay? So imagine that you have the tumor, you just expand it, and independently of this, the tumor is growing. Okay, so there are two processes happening in the same time. And of course, what we really need is this this gradient. And now, recently, Kim and Sun proposed an interesting equation of more of growth. So G was the growth function. And here, what you actually see here is actually the stress, the mechanical stress. It's the Hooke's law, E times epsilon strain. And that's the strain in our case, okay? The equation is still nonlinear. However, we can make something out of it, okay? First of all, the good part is that the drought now is somehow connected to the stress, the mechanical stress, and that's the step forward here. And we have investigated, of course, two different types of stretches, 0.1 and 10. What it turns out that all the way out to a lambda equal to 3, the two, the high and low grade, turned out to actually grow at the same rate. However, as lambda starts to increase, not only that the mechanical model is going to crash because we are in the linear regime, but we actually start to notice that actually the high grade, which is the red one, starts to actually have a much faster rate of growth than the low grade. By the way, the time was non-dimensionalized here since, again, I'm using experiments done by Sun, this type, Kim and Sun, and they were running these experiments, of course, at the microstructure level, while I'm trying to characterize this at the macroscopic level. So I have some discrepancies between different scales, okay? And we said, okay, how can we go a little bit farther? And the way to go farther here is actually looking into the fractional calculus. The reason why I became very interested lately in the fractional derivatives is because they can sharpen our understanding of equilibrium and long time limits. What happens in the when processes different processes in long ranges? And we started, of course, with the easiest way out was to replace the first order derivative with a fractional order derivative. Nothing else. And really, if you actually look at the way the fractional order derivative is actually defined, you can actually sense what's happening here. You see the growth function is now here inside a convolution operator, and then I take the time derivative. So it's like actually I'm connecting, rather than having just one macroscopic time scale, I have two of them. Something that happens at the microstructure, and then something that happens T is my macroscopic scale. So really what we have here is like a clock that connects the two time scales. Okay? And then we wonder if this actually might work to describe some nonlinearities that might happen in there. Look what's happening now. For alpha equals 0.5, which is here, something very interesting happens at this location. The log rate suddenly takes over. In other words, at around this point, the log rate lemma becomes very dangerous. Okay, so it looks like it's capturing something that we have not seen in the models before, namely when a benign-looking tumor becomes aggressive. Of course, we need some more information about what's happening in the biochemistry at the microscopic level, but nevertheless, it looks like this alpha is directly related to those models. And then, of course, for alpha greater than 0.5, again, they are pretty far apart. So this is safe. In other words, this patient probably can stay with that tumor. It's not aggressive. Oh, alpha was, sorry. Alpha is actually the fractional order of the derivative. Okay. And that's the important feature. It's something new in the mechanical model that I need to, that I'm guessing right now that connects the mechanics to the biochemistry. Okay? As you probably realize, from a mechanical point of view, I need as least as possible material parameters to fit to the experiment. That's one thing, especially for the brain tissue where you can't actually do any experiments. You really need very few parameters to have to fit with the experiment. And this is a way, a nice way out in a way. We were actually very pleased when we noticed this one because we have not seen before any such of clear-cut distinction what happens if benign tumor suddenly becomes aggressive, whatever reason for that to happen. And then the conclusions here. So information provided by the image mass spectroscopy can help with tumor classification, that's for sure. We're very happy to notice that the apparent Young modulus of high glioma is about 10 kilopascal higher than the low grade glioma. However, size matters. Again, I remind you, we actually compared that elastogram to the 14 kilopascal that was obtained at the macroscopy level. So we have to calibrate the model experimentally. The growth processes, however, are dependent on applied stresses, mechanical stresses. For small applied deformations, usually the low grade gliomas grow a little faster than the high gliomas, but for larger deformations, the high gliomas are going to be the most invasive ones. But the fractional order temporal derivatives, however, because it's introducing this multi-scaling time, it appears that it can model what happens with a low-grade glioma when it starts to grow aggressive. For the time being, however, our model is a little bit unstable for certain orders of the fractional order, so we still have to play with it, do a proper mathematical analysis, and see what exactly is happening there. And that being said, this is usually the discussion between the mathematician and the clinicians. And I think all of you have been exposed to that if